I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Cape Cod and the islands are known as a mecca for artists, and this includes writers. On today's program, we're talking about the creative writing process, what motivates us to write, what topics are inspirational, and what are the options to share work with an audience. Joining us in studio is Lauren Wolk. In addition to being the director of the Cultural Center,
Associate
director of the Cultural Center of Cape Cod, she's published several books, including the novel Wolf Hollow, which received a Newbery Honor. Always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Mindy.
Also with us is Alexandra Speck. In addition to her day job at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, she's just published a book, author of the novel Honor Girl. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Brian Engels joins us in addition to his jobs as a writing tutor and musician. He's the author of the novel This River Is Wild, which is coming up in April, right?
Yes, and the title actually changed over the last couple of months. Sorry
and
about that.
What's the new title?
It's called Wild Ball now.
Wild Ball. Okay, we'll be looking for that. So if you consider yourself a writer or just enjoy the creative process of putting your thoughts on paper, we hope you will join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So each of you are published writers, but you've taken different routes to get to publication. And we're going to talk about publishing a little bit later. But let's start with why you write. What motivates you or inspires you? Alex, let's start with you.
Okay. I think for me, it's one of those things that you can express yourself in a different way than you can just in your regular life. Like I'm a very animated person, and sometimes I feel like I have to wear like a personality burqa to just sort of like keep my personality under check. And I feel like when I'm writing, I don't have to do that. So it's a way for me to express myself and my creativity. And so yeah. I enjoy it for that reason.
And your humor, because you're a very funny person.
Thanks.
Hey, Lauren?
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I honestly, it sounds very pretentious to say it's like breathing. You know, you have to do it, but it's just what I do, and I don't know what I would do if I couldn't do it.
Have you always done it? I mean, since you were young?
Yeah.
So it is. It's just part of who you are.
Yeah. And sometimes I wish it weren't, because it's really hard. Mm-hmm. It's really, really hard to do. But it's so satisfying when you put words together in a way no one ever has before. And it, you know, somehow captures who you are and what you think and what you believe. It's the greatest thing in the world.
Brian?
I think I try to use it as a tool to make sense of relationships or certain experiences. I think I'm usually confused by myself or other people, and I try to use fiction or other forms of writing just as a way to re-examine something or ask myself a question of why did I do that or why did the other person make that decision? And I think art can be a helpful way to try to explore some of those dynamics.
We often hear from art, and Lauren, you're also an artist, we hear about this area and this region, especially I think when you go to the Outer Cape, the light, and you know, people talk about, you know, what an inspirational place this is. So living in this region, does that influence you at all or inspire you in your writing?
It has me, because setting is a huge, huge thing for me. And my most recent book, Beyond the Bright Sea, takes place here. So just being by the ocean in that case was incredibly important. But more to the point, the Cape is filled with people who get who I am and why I do what I do. And so I feel like I'm in excellent company, even though making art is a very isolating process. You know, when you're writing, it's you and you alone with your characters. But you go out into the world and you meet people who appreciate what you do, value who you are, and that's really huge.
Yeah. I mean, I found the same thing too. Just even with the people, like I actually started my writing with the Cape Cod Writer Center. There's so many opportunities and resources here for people who want to write, and you can meet some great people that you otherwise wouldn't hang out with or have met. That can help you and inspire you and keep you going in the writing process.
Yeah, Brian, I guess for you, you grew up here, so.
Yeah, I think it played a huge part in me ending up kind of being creative, I guess. Just apart from the landscape itself, you know, growing up right by the water, or just some of the trails and the nature around here, all of that's very inspiring. But also I've found that I gravitated towards a lot of other creative people growing up, that there were a lot of musicians growing up here, kids that were really into visual art, like painting, the film program I was a part of in high school. I just thought, it's just sort of part of this place's DNA, I think.
Yeah. All right. So you all are busy people. And Lauren, you mentioned it's hard to write. And it's hard, I imagine, for all of you to find the time to sit down and write. So how, you know, when I know, Lauren, you're a morning writer. So but I guess you also write whenever you can. So how do you find, how do you work that into your day with everything else that you all have going on?
That's a good question, because as your life evolves, so does your ability, you know, to find time to do the things you want to do. And I'm busier now than I've ever been. And the book I'm working on right now has been coming out in little bursts, which is very, very frustrating for me, because I am a binge writer to the extent that I can be. And I don't find it at all satisfying to just get rolling and have to be yanked out of the process mm-hmm. in order to go do something else. But that's the reality of my life and most of our lives. We're torn in many directions. So the key for me is to be able to sit down at that computer and instantly go into the zone. Mm-hmm. Just jump right in there and stay there as long as I possibly can.
Yeah. What about you, Brian?
I think that idea of the zone is something I really struggle with, because there are times when I sort of just get, I call them lightning bolts. You just sort of get like a vision or some sort of idea that you're just, you know, you have to run with, and, you know, always keep a notebook handy. And there are times when those things are just so immediate and the inspiration is there and you know what you're trying to capture. And then there are times when, oh, I have 2 hours this afternoon and I do not feel that at all. But you still just have to have that discipline to, you know, spend the first 10 minutes and maybe it's not happening. But if you put the time in, I think you can get to that.
Yeah, I'll like take notes on my phone, for example. Like I'll be driving and I'll be like, oh, I got to write something about that. Or I'll hear a piece of conversation and I'll write it in like the notes section of my phone and like want to come back to it and make sure it's not too cryptic that I can understand it later.
Yeah.
But I tend to write, you know, now I used to get a babysitter and block out like 2 hours of time and just try and get it done then. And now I do it mostly like at night when my kids are asleep.
Yeah. And that's a, I think, a lot of pressure. All right, I've got a babysitter. I've got these 2 hours. You've got this pressure. And if you're like not in the zone, like you're saying, and you're trying to pull, that's a mix. So does it energize you, exhaust you, or both writing?
I think both. Yeah.
Yeah.
Love, hate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's remember, people, I'm a lot older than these two. I didn't always find it easy to jump into the zone, and I still don't always find it easy. But when my kids were little and refused to nap, and nap time was my writing time, or I was so exhausted at the end of the day after looking after them and being a freelancer at home and all the rest of it that I just couldn't imagine staying up till 2 a.m. to write, although I did, I struggled really mightily with how I was going to pull this off. So it's like anything, though, you get good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you called it lightning bolts. I'm the opposite. Do you have writer's block? Do you believe in writer's block? And what do you do when that happens, if that happens to you?
It's funny because I really haven't struggled with that yet. It sounds so terrible to say that, but I haven't had a problem with inspiration. I really love music, and I get a lot of my ideas by going on a walk, listening to a playlist that I put together that I think the songs in that playlist would sort of be the soundtrack for the world of the book. Or I like to go to classical performances or rock concerts, and usually that's sort of just where I get my ideas. And so for me, it's sort of like a constant stream, and it's more about figuring out what ideas are worth running with and what ideas maybe are interesting to me, but aren't going to make for great art.
Right. Well, writer's block.
I don't find that I really have it either. Or sometimes I'll sit down and, you know, I have a blog and I find that's an easy way to write too, where it's like short bursts, like Lauren said, so you can be writing, but, you know, you feel like you finished something.
Yeah.
And I will, for example, sit down and I'll be like, I have nothing to say. Not at all. And then all of a sudden, like, it'll just come out. And so, and then I'll be like, wow, that was a great piece. Who knew that was in me? You know, or I think it's a great piece. But I think I have it and then I don't.
Yeah.
I have lots of tricks. I just, if I'm not feeling much like writing, I go back 10 pages and start to read. By the time I have tinkered my way through those last 10 pages, I have built up a head of steam and there's no block.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
It really works. And if I'm able to do this, I also leave the writing in the middle of a really cool place, even in the middle of a sentence, so that when I come back, there's this unfinished bit waiting for me. And then I just get into that bit and it leads me to the next bit. And before you know, the chapter's done.
Right, so you're talking about ideas, and Brian, you mentioned you get lots of ideas. So your minds are racing. You've got, you know, Alex, you're taking these notes, and you can't put out, you can't write about everything, all these ideas. And sometimes you have to put things like, and I'm sure I've heard other authors say this, there's a character or something that they kind of put over here, and that character won't let you forget them. Maybe they're in the next book or, you know, what have you. So what do you do with all of those ideas? Do you have lists? How do you keep track of them?
I count on my brain to filter. And if I remember it, it's worth remembering. And if I don't, it's not. I do write some things down, you know, but for the most part, I just trust myself. And there's way too much to write anyway. So the stuff that's most important will rise, mm-hmm. and that's what will take you over. And the rest of it will be for your next life.
I have a couple. I mean, I have a plethora of novels just sort of like on my computer that I've started with other characters and things that eventually I think I'll come back to. So I'll get an idea for something. Like I have a Murder Girl mystery series that's just on my computer, you know, that I'll get inspired by certain things. And then I'll come back to it later maybe, but it just doesn't take precedence right now.
Yeah. What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I have a couple stories in mind of what I want to do next. And I sort of just keep running Word documents, and if an idea comes along that I think might fit one of the next things I want to do, just to keep those on record so that you have the ideas later. And then it's funny because sometimes when you get that initial spark, you're so convinced, like, oh, this is a great moment. And then you open it up 2 months later and that same
totally.
Feeling
isn't there. That's
yeah.
funny.
You're like, this is awful. Right. I can't even believe I wrote this. It's so embarrassing.
Right. That's funny. How about if we have you read a little bit of each? You read something. Alex, you want to start? Read a little something from your book?
Sure. I'll choose a selection that has something to do with Woods Hole because my book, Honor Girl, is set in Woods Hole in New York City. I stood in front of the Lee side for about 5 seconds and pulled out my cell phone. It read 7:55. Was I too early? When Dave emailed me back, he said to meet him around 8. What does around 8 mean exactly anyway? I'm always 5 minutes too early, and I didn't want to look too overeager, so I decided to get water at the Food Buoy, the local corner store, and peruse U.S. Magazine to waste some time. The bells hanging above the Food Buoy door jingled as I entered. Well, hello there, Emma. Hot date tonight? Martin, the cashier, asked. No, I scowled back. Okay, yeah, wait. How can you tell? Do I have too much makeup on, or is my perfume too heavy? I said, licking the back of my hand and pawing at my neck to remove the perfume. Easy, Martin said. None of the above. Just notice you don't look as burdened as usual, and I can see some skin. I never thought I'd be described as burdened, but I sort of liked that it gave me some depth, a history. After all, I was the girl from New York. I needed some grit, some street cred. Yeah, well, I'm meeting a friend at the Leaside just for a drink or two. Must be some friend, he said sarcastically. Do I know him? Now, chances were that in this town he probably did. I don't know, his name's Dave? Ah, that helps a lot. Dave, he thought hard. You mean Package Store Dave or Scuba Dave? Why did all these guys have prefixes on their names, I wondered. Like there was a Ricky Coldcuss and Coast Guard Bob and Derby Dan. Maybe Scuba Dave, I asked Martin, taking a wild guess. I made the natural link between scuba diving and scup lover in his match tag. Cool. Good guy, Scuba Dave. He works on the Oceanus boat as a diver, Martin said. Well, this was a good sign, I thought. At least he had a good rap around town, and Martin knew just about everyone, as the Food Buoy was the only place to get groceries and provisions in Woods Hole. Well, that's a relief, I said. All right, I better go.
Lauren?
Wow. Well, I brought something that didn't get published. Just the first paragraph of a book I wrote called Forgiving Billy Pilgrim, a bunch of years ago. And I brought this because I think part of the conversation about writing and getting published is knowing that something that is really dear to you might not ever make it into print. And that was the case with this. It won a national award. It was twice nominated for other awards, but it never made it into print. And I think it's just because it was way too weird, which at times I am. So it's the very beginning. It's called starts with the beginning of the experiment. Somewhere in this world right now, one giant dog barks madly at the breathy thump of a bottled comet taking flight, while a girl, still a bit shy of a yard, gazes into the crannies of an old boat, thrilled to catch the eye of a simpatico spider. At the same time, 37 years later, this girl finds herself sitting at a stoplight, bemused by the bumper sticker on the truck in front of her. If you can read this, it says, thank a teacher. If it's in English, thank a soldier. She screams herself silent, her face bathed in blood, while the sky crackles with meteors. The sun rises, the sea rises, and white worms fall from nowhere like fat, voracious seeds. How can she stomach the smile exacted by an iron bit? How can she watch the slow demise of her own best inventions? At every turn, she is baffled by something, not least the endless confusion of being here. But as her experiment unfolds, she feels herself preparing to breathe again, and she finds herself at the bottom of the pool with Billy Pilgrim, forgiving him.
So, Lauren, you go back to something like this and you think, as you said, something that's dear to you, and you go, why didn't this get published? Do you try again? Do you ever submit it again and say, well, maybe it was just the wrong time?
Oh, that's a good question. The agent I had at the time actually gave up representing fiction in large part because this book didn't get published.
Wow.
This and other books of fiction he felt were worthy. And the award that two editors nominated it for, the Pushcart Editors Book Award, is only books that have been rejected by mainstream publishers are eligible for this award, because it wasn't the quality of the fiction. I know this sounds very self-aggrandizing. Mm. I apologize for that. But this is the book, I think, probably the best thing I've ever written, this book. Mm. It's about when I was a teacher here on the Cape and trying to be perfect. I've given that up, but both of those things, actually. But I think it's probably the best thing I ever wrote or ever will write. And yet it's the thing that didn't get published, I think, in large part because it's freakishly honest. I don't know why.
Yeah. You know
I
think you should try again. I think you should try again.
It's a crapshoot.
Can I ask a question? Is that's a Vonnegut reference?
It is. She's a teacher who's about to teach Slaughterhouse-Five to her students, and they do an experiment where they try and keep track of the many places in their lives they travel, metaphorically.
Wow.
Right.
That was cool.
Yeah, Brian, can we hear something from your upcoming book?
Yeah, so this is the first page of Wild Ball, and the first chapter is called Lost Boys. Growing up out west, Shane witnessed a handful of forest fires, but never one that emitted such a menacing glow. He examined the night sky from the ballpark and the thick wisps of crimson fog that hovered in the distance. It was a violent shade of red, like some kind of northern lights gone wrong. He half expected the ominous cloud to build and descend onto Hinton Fields, consuming the Briggs in one gulp, but the fog remained in place, floating and stagnant. "Shane, what's taking you so long?" Coach Hale called from the diamond. He turned back to his team. They all seemed puzzled by his prolonged trip to left field. "Do you guys see..." Shane trailed off, realizing the only thing his new teammates were staring at was him. If it was a sign of inferno, Shane thought, then there would have been sirens, and these guys would have tossed their gloves down in panic. He scanned the field for the grounder that slipped past him when the hellish smoke claimed his focus. Shane whipped the ball back towards home and jogged to his place in the middle infield, trying to force the devil sky out of his mind.
Hmm. Look forward to reading that book. This is about the... it's not the Cape League in your book, but it's
inspired by the
that,
Cape
yeah.
League. I call it the Cove League,
okay.
Just to, you know, keep things fictional.
Cool.
We are talking about creative writing and the process. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about creative writing and the process with Lauren Wulk. She is the author of Wolf Hollow and several other books. Alexandra Speck, her new book is Honor Girl, and Brian Engels, whose novel Wild Ball will be coming out in April. 866-999-4626 is our telephone number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Laura is giving us a call from Edgartown. Hi, Laura.
Oh, hi. It's actually Anne, I think.
Oh, Anne. Okay. Hi, Anne.
I just wanted to very quickly say that I was just listening to the paragraph the author read about that relates to Billy Pilgrim, and I just wanted to echo your encouragement. Please publish it. I will read it for sure.
Oh, boy. Thanks, Anne.
Anne, thanks for that. Yeah, we all think she should try again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was just beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to chime in, or shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so do you have an audience in mind when you're writing?
someone who's breathing. I mean, I do now because I have contracts to write books for middle grade readers, but I do not write for young readers. I write for readers. Mm-hmm. But I do my best to keep in mind some of the things that made Wolf Hollow write for that book and then Beyond the Bright Sea.
Let me go back to Wolf Hollow for a second, okay. Because you wrote that not thinking what the audience would be. You didn't write that thinking this was going to be for middle graders.
I thought it would be for adults because I had one book out for adults, so it just never occurred to me it would be for anyone else.
And when I read that book, I felt like it was a book for adults. I mean, there are some themes in there that I thought would kind of go over younger kids' head. But who decides that? Is your publisher the one that says, well, this is what we're going to market it
my
to?
When I sent it to my agent, this was a new agent I had to get for this book because my last one gave up on fiction. She said, oh, this is a perfect book for young readers. And I fell out of my chair. And actually, I had sent it to him and he thought the same thing. I couldn't fathom it. She said, well, it's a young protagonist. It's a clean book. You know, it's not filled with things that are inappropriate for young readers. And it's a compelling story. Why not? I said, well, there's no why not. I'm thrilled. It just didn't occur to me. But what you said a minute ago, Mindy, about things going over people's heads, I've met with thousands of kids now who've read the book. They are smart as whips. Mm. They don't miss a trick.
So what I think is going over their heads, they're getting it.
They are so getting it. And I've also heard, you know, the book's a little dark for young people. Young people like dark.
Yes,
they
get do.
Dark. Yeah. They're not stupid. They know all about dark.
Yeah. So now that you write Wolf Hollow not thinking about what age group is going to read this. And I think, you know, Marty Sandler says this about his books when he writes a lot of books for young readers. Mm-hmm. Same thing. He says, I don't try to talk down. I just write the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, for any age.
Yeah, and later your editor will say, you know, this right here might need a little more. You might need to speed this up a little bit in the beginning. You things that they know about a younger audience, and that's fine. But I wouldn't ever write down to a reader ever.
What about you, Alex? Were you thinking of an audience when you wrote this?
No, I mean, I really think you can't think about anybody reading it. It's more something that's just coming out in you, and you hope that, you know, someday someone will read it, which is really exciting to think about. I think for me, it's one of those things, like my voice tends to be more in a genre of like a chick lit, or it's just who I am. You know, I mean, I think all this writing is so beautiful, but like that's probably not going to come out of me necessarily. So I don't write for a particular audience. I just sort of like write, you know, how I talk or.
Right. I think people can't help but like chuckle at a lot of the things you, I mean, because you're funny and you are in person funny too. So your writing reflects that. And I think when somebody's like looking for a couple of laughs in a book, that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, my book is really light. I tell people it's like a beach read. You can read it and like, you know, listen, I'm not pretending I'm Joyce Carol Oates or like, you know, but I'm just myself. And I think that, you know, it's like 200 something pages of hanging out with a, you know, like a friend or something. It's fun. I just think it's, you know, light and easy.
All right, Brian, were you thinking of an audience when you wrote your book?
I had written one book before Wild Ball, another YA book that didn't really find any success with trying to reach out to agents for representation. So I kind of felt this mission to write another YA book and something that I felt like would earn its place in the world. So I knew I wanted it to be for younger readers, but to echo what Alex and Lauren were just saying, I don't think you keep that in mind when you're like in the cave, mm-hmm. you know, because you can't have that that idea of an audience when you're mm-hmm. just trying to get it out. Like they were saying, I think inevitably that always comes along later when you're shaping things more.
Did you play baseball?
I did not play baseball
growing
up.
Okay, so then talk about the research. What kind of research did you have to do, and how long did it take the research part of your book?
Yeah, so I went to a lot of Cape League games. My nephews, who lived here when I was writing the book, the oldest boy got really into Little League. That was a fun way to do some research, sort of helping him train for the sport, and then both of us sort of falling in love with it at the same time, me much later in my life. Watching a lot of sports and just doing research on some of the guys that come out and come to compete for the Cape League, finding out a little bit about what their life is like growing up with that very singular goal in mind, which obviously takes a very different skill set than writing, but I find myself having that almost same tunnel vision of there's one thing I'm trying to do, and it's get this book out, you know. Yeah. And those guys are, they have a similar trajectory.
What about research for you, Alex?
I think research for me is, it comes from the breadth of experience I have in terms of, you know, the different, I've had about 50,000 jobs and in my life, you know, I was an actress for a while. So that's also in the book. She was a former actress. And a lot of people say, oh, is that you? And it's not me. You know, like when I moved to Woods Hole, I got married right away. I didn't date on Match and all that stuff. But I think, you know, it's one of those things that just comes from your experience. And I think they also often say, you know, and not in this case for you, Brian, but sometimes it takes an older person to be able to write, you know, write because you have stuff to write about. And I think that, you know, I just pull from my experiences and, you know, I lived in Woods Hole, so I knew all the references and I knew, you know, the locations and things like that. And same with New York City.
Write about what you know, they say. Right?
Yeah, write what you know, you know, and so that was really my, a lot of my research was just, you know, what was my experience.
All right, Lauren, research for you, because your books are very different.
Well, and they're historic fiction, and I wasn't alive at the times when they took place. But with Wolf Hollow, it was based on the farm that my mother's family has owned for 200 years, and I've spent a lot of time there. So I didn't really have to do much research, and if I did, I just called my mother and said, what kind of board games did you play when you were a kid? Or, you know, did you have pecans growing in the area? Things I needed to know for the book. But Beyond the Bright Sea, I did a lot more research because it was set on Penikese and Cuttyhunk in the 20s, and I needed to know everything from what kind of wildflowers grew there to how the ferry ran out of New Bedford. But I find that I don't do research before I start. I do research as I have questions to which I need answers. Because if the research drives the book, it's not mine anymore. But I do need to do, I need to fill the gaps as I go. And so I sometimes am then steered a little bit by what I discover. And that's fun. But most of the time, it is serving me rather than me serving it.
I want to talk about your characters and character development. Sometimes you're writing this story and, you know, things are going great. And there's this character you have who maybe is just a small character, but they won't let you keep them a small character. They kind of, in a lot of ways, I hear Rogers say, you know, this character just kept, you wanted to be bigger in the story, or, you know, or a character you maybe not had planned is just working their way. So what's going on with these? I mean, how do these characters come to life for you, Lauren?
I always start with place, and then I add one character, and then I set her loose or him loose, and then I just follow. And I run into characters and add them if they seem compelling to me and to my protagonist. I occasionally take a character out. I'm about to do that in the book I'm working on right now. There's a man in the book, and I know he's there because my dad was reading the first few pages, and he said, "Where's the villain?" And I thought, oh, crap, I better add a villain. Well, no, this villain doesn't belong in this book, and he's going to be gone. He's right. Going to be a gone villain. And maybe he'll appear somewhere else. But, you know, I'm a firm believer in listening to your gut. Your gut doesn't lie to you. Mm-hmm. And if your gut feels a little squeamish when you're dealing with a character, chances are he or she doesn't belong there, just misplaced.
Yeah. Brian, what about you?
I think it's interesting because I usually take real life people I know as inspiration, but it's funny when they get to a point in literature or when you're writing, when they become their own entity, you know. And I had a moment when I was writing one of the earlier drafts of this book where one of the characters literally sort of said to me, "No, I'm not doing that. Like, I'm not doing what you had in mind for me in this story." And I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess you're your own person now, and I'm not in control of you, even though I'm writing this book. And I think it's that idea of if they get to a point where they really are their own characters now and not just somebody that you're basing them off, that's when you know that they're in a good spot. And if you can have that gut feeling that Lauren was talking about of, maybe you're trying to make them do something they don't want to do or that isn't true to the character you've built, you have to listen to those moments. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it changes your story, but you have to roll with it.
Yeah. Alex?
What happened with me was, you know, one of the characters in my book who was sort of what you would call like an extra in the job that I had, my imaginary job at Cape Cod Hospital as a research assistant, she became so interesting to me as I was writing her that I put her in more scenes and more, and she became basically one of the main characters, Kimmy. And I had no plan on having her have anything to do with the life outside of the research center.
So as you're adding scenes with Kimmy, are you going, I really like her?
Yeah. It's just like, I was like, she's so dysfunctional like me. I love her. Let's put her in more scenes. But yeah, yeah, she came to life.
So some people write for themselves and they have no desire to share their work with anybody else. It's just a private thing for themselves. And then, of course, others seek an audience. A good first option, I guess, for sharing your work is writing groups. So what's been your experience with writing groups? And Alex, I know you mentioned that you started with Cape Cod Redison. What was your experience?
I had a great experience. You know, they matched me up with these two women that, you know, they were older. We met in Starbucks in Mashpee Commons. And I was like, hey, I'm Alex. And, you know, it was kind of awkward, but then we became really good friends. And one of them is this woman, Jamie Cat Callan, who is another writer here. And so we would meet at Cape Cod Bagel, and we called it CCBU, which is Cape Cod Bagel University. And I was like, I'm getting my MFA at CCBU. And we would read pages to each other in those back little like carols, sort of. That was our, you know, carols or whatever, a booth. And I had a great experience, and I think it's really important to put your work in front of other people before you go ahead and publish it. And it's great to get another ear or another, you know, set of eyes on it, essentially. And that's what I did. I had all of my pages read by them. And it also gave me a sense of urgency or a deadline. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would have just really not shown up. Like, there were a lot of times that I was like, I don't have any time to write. But I was meeting, you know, mm-hmm. Jamie and Brenda at CCBU on Wednesday, so I had to crank something out. And so it was great to give myself a deadline.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Lauren?
I for 18 years, I've been a member of the Bass River Revisionists, which is just an outstanding writers group, mostly poets. And I'm a poet, too, so I tend to take poetry to the group. But I also there are members of it who will read a long work, and I've relied on them heavily to give me feedback. My parents read my work. Other friends read my work. And my sister, who is the most brutally honest person I know, reads my work when I have the courage to give it to her, and she'll tell me, she'll speak truth, and it's you need that, you really do.
What about you, Brian?
I'm in a writers group with two other writers that live here in Falmouth, Bronwyn Prosser Poloni, who's an excellent playwright, and Amy Wilson Sanger, another terrific writer, and some people might know her from her work with the Brazen Bells too, but it's such an amazing group. There's this level of accountability that comes with it. We alternate who brings in pages every week. We had a reading at the old firehouse in June. That was such a cool experience to, you know, organize that, see the community come out. And especially when you can share your work with people that you trust, it's really great to have that level of, you know, just trust with each other is really great.
I'll say, and like with your sister, you're saying she's going to be brutally honest, and as tough as sometimes that might be to hear, it's important because sometimes you're a little bit too close to your work to notice some of the or a question. There might be this question that you haven't answered that you go, wow, I didn't realize I didn't answer that question. So that's important. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about creative writing with Lauren Wolk, author of Wolf Hollow and a couple of other books, Alexandra Speck, author of Honor Girl, and Brian Engels, his novel Wild Balls, coming out in April. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. We are evidently having some trouble with email, so no email this morning. I imagine you all are having a great experience with your writing groups, but I imagine that finding that right fit can be tough. So what advice do you give people who are going, I'd like to join a writing group. What do I look for? How do I know I'm in the right group?
Well, first of all, if it's a poetry group and you're a fiction writer, you better be sure that there are some people who want to read fiction out of you. So maybe the idea is first think about that. But I think the culture of the group is the most important thing. Trust. Mm-hmm. Brian said trust. Mm-hmm. You absolutely have to trust the people in your group. They have to be there for the right reason, not just to read their own work. They really want to hear what you've done, too, and to give you constructive advice. Mm-hmm. If it's constructive, if it's all creative part of the creative process, that's wonderful. But I've been in a couple of groups where it was just people who wanted to read their own work and then get up and go home. And that's poison.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that my group sort of battles with is having projects that we're still trying to find where they're going. And like we talked about earlier, sometimes it's difficult to let other people in when you're still finding a project. So that's something that is you have to be very careful because I'm very sensitive about my work, and so you have to pay the same respect and be careful about the kind of questions you ask, and just being okay that you don't have the answers yet of maybe where this thing is headed.
I think, yeah, just being, you find your people, you know, kind of like you do in life, and they relate to you, and, you know, their work resonates with you, even if it's not your particular genre. You like it, and you can learn from them, and they come, and they do the work, and they're not just showing up with, like, a half-written, you know, page on a napkin or something, but they're really there, and they're committed to the group, and commitment is a lot of part of a good group, the people who are present and who read your work and really give honest feedback.
Let's talk about the relationship with editors, a little bit more formal than the writing group. So, Lauren, what's been your experience with the editorial? You have a wonderful editor.
Oh, thank God I have her. Julie Strauss-Gable. She's Dutton, which is part of Penguin Random House. I will tell this tiny story, and it'll make me sound like an egomaniac, but when I finally found an agent, when she sent out Wolf Hollow, she had 7 offers in 5 days, and I got to spend an hour with each editor on the phone. And I'd never been wooed like that in my life. I'd never had suitors like these. They were amazing. And I chose Julie because she was the one who wanted to change the book. You know, she was the one who said, I think we could do this. I think we could do that. And she didn't try to, there was not an inkling that she wanted to rewrite it for me. She's not a frustrated writer. She saw ways to make it a better book. And that's all I really wanted in an agent. And that's what she's been for me. And I cannot explain clearly enough how important it is to have somebody you trust like that to help you through the revision process, to show you things you're too close to see.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, my editor saved my novel. I don't think it was terrible before she came along, but her name's Kate Barnett. She's the president of an online media company named Man Repeller. Bit of a cheeky name there. They do a lot of open and vulnerable storytelling. And we've worked together the last 3 months. And I just to reiterate some of what Lauren just said, sometimes you're just so close to your book and you spent so many hours on it, you lose that ability to be able to make certain calls or decisions anymore. And so Kate came along this fall and was really able to hone in on what the central thread we were supposed to follow was. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with editing, I try to think about it like Jenga. You know, you're like taking away the most amount of blocks but still keeping the structure. And Kate was really able to diagnose, this can go, this needs to stay. And it's been terrific to work with her.
And Alex, you're self-published, right?
Yep.
So who did your writer friends as editors? Who was your editor?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like the ghetto version of like writing here. Yes, my friends in the writing group would edit the pages and say, you know, that doesn't make sense or whatever in terms of content. And then this is one of the caveats of self-publishing. I sort of impetuously did it on a whim, like I do many things. Jump and the net will appear seems to be my motto. And I sort of published it, and then I'm like, wait, oh my God, I haven't read it in like 4 years. Maybe I should go look at it and see if there's any typos. And so I basically then found, I have a friend who's a copy editor. So I had her, after I self-published it, go back, fix some things, because people are like, yeah, there was like words missing.
Oh, no.
You know, which is, it's tough. Like, what can, you know, so.
I just goes to show you need an editor. Somebody.
You need an editor.
Yeah, everybody needs an editor.
You know,
Everybody
would love to have an editor, but not everybody can have an editor.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to Denise, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Denise.
Hi there. Good morning. What a great show. I'm a huge fan of Lauren's and also a fan of her earlier book, whose name I've forgotten, Lauren. But
Those Who Favor Fire.
Mm-hmm. Those Who Favor Fire, yes. But today my youngest grandchildren are arriving, and last Christmas we read Wolf Hollow out loud as a family while they were here. And this year I got them Beyond the Bright Sea, which I'm looking forward to hearing their opinion of it too. But I also was really interested in your discussion of editors. My husband, who was a scientist but a writer, always said everybody needs a good editor and even a good editor. So mm-hmm.
Thank you, Denise. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yes, thanks for calling, Denise. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to chime in, that's 866-999-4626. All right, Lauren, that was something I wanted to ask you about. Your first book was written a while ago.
It was published in May 2016. Oh, my first book.
Those Who Favor Fire.
Yeah, I was 30 when I wrote that. And there's a cautionary tale about the need for an agent. I didn't have one when Random House published that. And it took 7 years from mm-hmm. the time I sent it in to the time it actually finally hit the shelves. And it was a very painful, torturous process. Mm-hmm. I learned a great deal about a lot of things, but especially mm-hmm. about the need for an agent.
Yeah,
they earn their commission.
Yeah, and so there's a big gap there between that book coming out and then you're writing Wolf Hollow.
Yeah,
did you get discouraged? That didn't get published. But, yeah.
There were a lot of discouraging moments. I can remember sitting on the floor crying my eyes out when Forgiving Billy Pilgrim didn't get published mm-hmm. because I put my heart and soul into that book. And I know you said earlier, some people just write for themselves, and that's called journaling. Mm-hmm. If you write a novel, you want people to read it. I don't care what anybody mm-hmm. says. And it hurt, to put all that work and all of myself into this thing that didn't get published. But and so, yes, there have been moments of despair, but you keep on. Mm-hmm. You just do it.
Well, I guess that goes to show, right? I mean, Wolf Hollow and Beyond the Bright Sea have done very well.
They have.
And, it's all good.
You never know what's coming, what the next chapter is going to be.
Yeah. So in this editing process, and Brian, you sort of touched on this, you're too close and you don't see that something needs to go or be expanded or whatever. With the editors, since the two of you have worked with editors, was there things that were tough for you to say goodbye to that you went, I don't know if I agree with you? Or do you just trust in that editor and make your changes?
Usually there's the initial response of, no, I'm not cutting that. that has to stay. And then take 15 minutes and then you consider, okay, that is a good point. And then you start to see their point of view and realize they have the story's best interests in mind mm-hmm. and that you're both working towards this, final vision of it almost, and that there are those, those little darlings, whether they're lines of dialogue that have been there mm-hmm. since the first draft or maybe descriptions. One little argument me and Kate go back and forth about is the uniforms of the team. I just had this two paragraph, these are the stripes that go down the center of the jersey and the accents. And, Kate was like, this sort of slows this page down. I don't know if we need to know every detail of the uniform,
And that's funny.
We go back and forth.
But. And Lauren, you mentioned that your editor doesn't say change this, but
Yeah, she's really sharp. If she had asked me to dumb it down for kids, I would have said bye-bye.
Yeah.
She never did. She never asked me to change a single word because it was because of the audience, not really. Mm-hmm. But she did ask me to take out a small character who I loved. Mm-hmm. And I broke the cardinal rule that I can't believe I broke. But I included this character because she existed in my mother's life growing mm-hmm. up, and I found her to be a compelling part of her family history. So I included her, and I thought she played a role, but Julie, my editor, said, no, she doesn't belong there. She's a sore thumb. Take her out. I said, really? She said, it's your book, but I really, really, really strongly advise you to take her out. And I know she's right because it took me 10 minutes to lift her out. She mm-hmm. she had no connective tissue to mm-hmm. the rest of the book. I just plucked her out of the places where she existed, and she was gone, and the book was better for it.
Mm. I was just going to say, too, with having other people read it and editing it, a lot of times you'll write a character, and you know what they look like, and you know who they are, but you don't necessarily they're not fleshed out enough. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to hear somebody say to you, I forgot to mention, what the person looked like. Like they were, I forgot to mention the color of their hair or something like that. And you're like, oh, wait, I knew that, but you didn't know that. So it's really nice to have somebody give you feedback.
Well, and your character, Beyond the Bright Sea, with the accent, we're not really sure.
Oh, that was fascinating because I didn't want You didn't, and it's sorry to disagree with you, although, of course, that's what artists do. I don't want to describe my characters. I really want the readers to, for the most part, decide what they look like. And in this case, what Osh sounded like. Yeah. I didn't want to say where he was from, just somewhere beyond the sea. Yeah. And then we did the listening library version, the audio version. And they said, what's his accent like? And I said, why do you care? And they said, because we want to give him an accent. And I said, well, Eastern European is the best I can do. I figured he was Armenian or Ukrainian, probably. I said, just sound vaguely Russian. So they were okay with that. But I objected to that. I did not want to pin it down at all.
Yeah. A lot of times they say characters, you know, you mentioned based on some real life people, Brian. And Alex, you get the question all the time, is Emma you?
Yeah.
So where does that, you know, where does that distinction, where does it, you're starting to use some of your experience, but then Emma becomes her own person. Where's that line? I mean, when you were writing Emma, were you thinking, oh, this I'm going to make her own person? Or was she experiencing some of the things you did?
I think 100% she was her own person. I think I realized in looking back at the book now that it was one of those things that I was writing kind of like, what if my life had taken a different turn when I moved to Woods Hole? Like, this is maybe what would have happened. And so it was a way for me to sort of like work out my life through my writing and maybe some wishful thinking, like maybe it would have been fun to go on a date at the Lee Side. maybe it would have been, you know, all these things, like what if I had taken a different turn kind of. And so, it definitely wasn't me. It was just based on, you know, you have to write from things you know. And so is that.
What about your characters? Brian, you sort of mentioned you had one who said, nope, I'm not going to do that. And he became his own. So they're based on real people, but they become their own character.
Yeah, I think that happens over the course of writing several drafts, that they, because of these situations that you're putting them in, they start developing their own ways that they're going to react or their own way that they talk. That instance that I mentioned earlier, at an early point in the novel, the main character, Shane, he destroys a piece of public property, a garden that his host mother has designed for the town. He finds something out that's very troubling, and he just takes his rage out in a very destructive way. And there's a point in the first third of the novel where the host family discovers this information. And in the earlier versions of the draft, I had this crazy idea that Shane was going to keep living there, you know, after this incident. And that was the moment where the host mother sort of, I like heard her voice sort of like from the computer screen say to me, like, no, like, this
He's
isn't going to
go.
Work.
Yeah.
This isn't going to work. And so in that instance, it was a dramatic situation that the character sort of let me know, hey, I know you're writing this thing, but you gotta, you gotta change course here.
And you know, I know you probably all get that question: how do you get published? And you know, Alex, you just went out and did it yourself, and a lot of people are doing that now. We're seeing a lot.
Well,
more.
I tried. I didn't just do that. I mean,
oh, so you did try to get it.
Yeah, it was like 4 years ago. I wrote some query letters. Yeah. And
it's hard because there's a lot of people writing books.
I've written query letters. Now that it's self-published, you still want to get a publisher, so it can get beyond the Bourne Bridge. But basically, I wrote the letters kind of similar to what Brian said or Lauren did, you know, and it didn't get picked up, or people were like, oh, I like it, but it's, you know, it's not for me, or it's not my genre or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I just was like, ugh, I'm busy. And I just dropped the ball. I'm like, forget it. Like, I guess it's going nowhere. And it was just sitting on my laptop, like I said, for like the last 4 years. And finally, I was like, you know, whatever. Like, now self-publishing, people do it now. It's not as frowned upon as it used to. Maybe it'll take off. And
We have less than a minute, but I want to talk about marketing with you because, you know, obviously you've got a harder job at marketing. You've got to do it all yourself.
I have to do it all myself. And also, like, to get it to local bookshops, which I'd love to support, like Eight Cousins and Market Street Bookshop, I have to order the book myself, pay for it, then drive it to Eight Cousins and say, do you guys need more?
Yeah.
And then keep filling the shelves myself, keep track of it. Same with Coffee O. It's definitely a lot. And it's up to me to get the book out there. Nobody else is helping me. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Lauren, real quick, just advice you give people who are looking to get published or marketing.
Well, I lost both my editor who died at Random House and my agent. So I had to start all over again with the next book. And I went online and looked for agents looking for new work. And I found one. Mm-hmm.
Real quick, Brian, advice
on marketing. I'd say that don't be afraid to put yourself out there and know who you're trying to get in touch with. Know who your readers are.
Right. Brian Engels' book, Wild Ball, coming out in April. Alexandra Speck, her book, Honor Girl, is out. And Lauren Wolk, her novel, Wolf Hollow, she's going to be, her latest book is Beyond the Bright Sea. She's going to give me a talk at the Cape Cod Museum of Art titled Surviving Both Failure and Success. Check the website for the date. Keeps changing, I guess, with our pending snowstorm coming. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate
Thanks,
your time
Mindy.
This morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.